Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
That we can't really know anything, if you think about it. We can't know ourselves. We can't know down to the very bottom of their motivations, the people around us, the world in which we live. I mean, life is a mystery. And alas, you know, however smart you are, however hard you work, you'll go to your grave having asked far more questions than you'll ever answer. So classics, the object of classics, antiquity, is like everything else in our world. It's just that it's a very interesting, vibrant, and strangely circumscribed example of this problem of not being able to know something completely, systematize it entirely.
Why read the ancient classics? What do we learn from them? And is Homer's epic long poem, The Odyssey, still relevant to us today? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the beauty, the mystery and allure of the ancient Greek world and ask, is it possible to define or curate the past? British poet, writer and teacher David Constantine unpacks the relationship between grief, memory and trauma. An American classic scholar, Dr. Shane Butler, talks deep classics. This is a show about past and present, love and loss, and the liminal spaces in between. But first, The Life Writer with David Constantine.
My name is David Constantine. I was for 30 years or so a teacher of German language and literature at university, and I've carried on those interests. Translation has always been very important for me throughout, and quite a lot of my writing has had to do with between the languages and between the cultures. I've been very lucky in my literary life. I was one of the very first people that Blood Axe Books in the northeast of England took on. I've been with him now for more than 30 years. And Ra Page of Comma Press, who was set up just to do short stories, I was just about one of his first two or three authors as well. So those are the two things that I've primarily done, poetry and short stories. And I did write a novel many years ago, a short one. But this, The Life Writer, is the most ambitious novel I've written. What I'd like to do now is read actually the first page and a half of the novel, which introduces the characters. Eric, the man who's dying, his wife, Katrine, and already, I think, after a page and a half, the central problem for her of the novel is becoming apparent. Then Eric said, "I don't want to be like that colleague of yours, Dennis, what's his name? I don't want to be like him, clinging on, nothing else in his head every minute of every day, nothing, only clinging on. I don't call that living when all you think about is staying alive." He halted. They looked at one another, and the man Eric did not want to be like appeared in the cold gap in their conversation, the man whose only thought was not to die, who had no other interest, no other conversation, nobody else's doings, hopes, fears interested him in the least. Nothing in the world outside himself, no past, present or future, nothing. All he thought about and spoke about was how not to die. He trawled the web for cures, and the last he hit upon was carrot juice. He carried a large bottle of it in his briefcase and took a glass on the hour, every hour, in whatever company and wherever he happened to be. Nothing else. No other food or drink. Just in time, he said, "I've found the one thing that will work." To his wife, family, friends, colleagues, strangers, he became a living horror, his black eyes, black as anthracite, burning brilliantly in his sunken face. And that was what he was remembered for, his final year, when he thought and spoke of nothing but staying alive. The potion supposed to cure him dyed him through and through, and his frightened eyes shone blackly from the holes in his yellow head. "No," said Katrine, "I don't want you to be like poor Dennis. Of course I don't. But you can't just give up." "I haven't," Eric answered, "and I promise you I won't." But it was as though some current or the tide had found him and was beginning to exert an attraction no amount of love would be able to withstand. He would turn, sink, and be taken away from her, far, far away, quite beyond her reach. the onset of that remoteness showed in his face sometimes, like the vagueness in the face of a pregnant woman, the look of belonging elsewhere, a look Katrine could not bear. He took her hand across the breakfast table. "I can't complain," he said. "I've had a good life, only 2 years short of my 70 years and 10. That's not young. Think of the people at school and university with me. Dead already," said several of them, 10, 20, 40 years ago, let alone the poets, painters and musicians you write about. So many of them dying so very young. I can't complain.
What a remarkable book, David. Really well done on the life writer. It brings up so many different themes related to love, loss and grief and how we understand it all. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with. Do you think we can ever let go of our first loves, or at least let go of the memory of our first loves?
Well, I've thought about that more since, because when the film was made, 45 years of my short story in another country, it was only then that I wrote the story itself 20 years ago. And it was only then when the film came out and I saw it that I realized that I'd employed exactly this, or more or less the same structure in The Life Writer. And it was the same structure because, in a sense, the same thing was going on. That is to say, into a person's life living in the present, the past erupted in the case of In Another Country. It was particularly violent and unbearable because the two people were so old. But in the case of Katrine, the chief, well, writer, really, of this book, the life writer, it's exceedingly painful for her to have to deal with a past, her husband's past, which wrongly, she begins to conceive of as less than the life that he had with her, as a kind of a passionate life in the past which she and he together have not been able to emulate. And I suppose the whole risk for her, and at times it's very close to being fulfilled, the risk for her is that she simply annihilates herself in the wish to, feeling of responsibility almost, to recover her husband's life. Because as she goes through the documents of his life, the letters, and talks to his best friend Daniel about the time which they come to call back then, a long time before, as she writes, and this is a fact about writing in a way, the better you do it, the less bearable it becomes, because the more convincingly and thoroughly you summon up the past, there's a grave risk that will, as it were, outdo the present in which you're trying to continue a life. I mean, I tried to write a novel which in the end, you know, showed her struggle, but did leave her with life opening up into a life more of her own than that, which is not a question of forgetting him. I'm not suggesting that. I ought to say perhaps already this. Although I understand why people want closure after very terrible events, I don't actually believe that that is a human possibility. I don't think we achieve closure, and honestly speaking, I don't think we should even attempt to. There's a way of dealing with the past, one hopes, that would actually incorporate it in the living now so that the past would continue in the present, ideally speaking, in some kind of beneficent fashion rather than malevolent.
Do you think the past can be defined in terms of how we understand it and process it? Do you think that we can ever fully grasp all the different complexities within different moments in our lifetime or our loved ones' lifetimes?
I don't think we can. And again, that is really a central inquiry in the novel. Everything shifts. There are points in the novel when she's simply overwhelmed with the plethora of tiny details, sometimes tiny little documents and bus tickets or stuff like that, which she's kind of hoarded, kept as ephemera of that sort. And what these things meant back then and what they mean now, clearly they are the same things, but the significance of them absolutely doesn't stand still. Doesn't stand still in any period of time. And the thing I came to realize in writing it, I suppose realized it again, is effectively speaking, for human beings, there is only a present tense. And things clearly are, chronologically speaking, in the past. And there is another tense in which things exist or don't exist, will come into being in the future. But as far as human beings are actually concerned in their living, you are there in the present when you remember things, the memory of those things takes place in the present tense of your being where you are. And of course, it's got to then sort itself with the person you now are, not the person you were at the period of your life, in the tense, if you like, in which those things first really occurred.
But present tense doesn't really allow us as human beings to have ownership of the past and take it for ourselves. It raises so many grey areas, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Again, I think the perspectives in this particular novel, they're not, you know, there are two or three significant ones, but they're not infinite. But if you split every person into his or her own possible perspectives at any one time, then the thing is so shifting. I mean, that's in a sense, that's just a factor of being alive, that nothing stands still. So you couldn't possibly claim ownership of anything. And one of the worries that, you know, I've written a biography myself, and I was aware while I was doing it that and an awful lot of biography, particularly modern ones, which are kind of 900 pages long, it really is as though they want to fix this past life down in a form which will be indisputable. But that's just not possible, and it's not even a thing that you should, I think, desire to do. It's the very fact of many-sidedness and instability, which is the fact of life, and in a sense, I think, it's a fact of life to be celebrated rather than worried about. I mean, worry is the wrong word. I mean, it is upsetting, but it is just how things are.
Do you think it's fair to describe The Life Writer as a love story, David, or how would you describe it?
Oh, it is a love story, and I think it's a love story which goes back to a period in a young man's life and a young woman's life, Monique and Eric, where they're at that stage of their lives when a love of that nature is all consuming. I mean, that is the passages in the novel that make that, I think, clear, that is effectively, if you said, what are you doing? Well, what they are doing is being in love and everything within the world of that. So it's an all-obsessive, all-absorbing state to be in. And, you know, if people are lucky enough to have had it, know what it feels like. It's also absolutely fraught with the danger of, I think in Monique's case, in the end, she just feels it's too much. It's not actually bearable because whatever they do, it kind of exceeds their power or her power to feel she has any control over it. There's absolutely no reason in reality for Katrine to feel that her love for Eric and Eric for her, in, as it were, the present tense up to his death, is less than that. But it's certainly different, and that's a matter, again, of phases of life. So I think of it, you know, very much indeed as a love story with the difficult and very different phases and kinds of being in love, if you like.
It raises so many different questions, but it got me thinking that within all of that love, the idea of letting go, and that is part of love, and whether letting go is part of the processes of grief.
Yeah, I mean, I've always worked to the kind of equation, really, that the more love, the more grief. It seems to me you can't avoid that equation. And again, it's something you should rejoice in rather than regret. But it obviously brings with it, if the equation is correct, then the more you love, the more you suffer. What you don't want to happen, what Eric doesn't want to happen to Katrine, and what she herself doesn't want to happen to her, is that you be so overwhelmed by grief that you can't actually continue a life of your own. And particularly in her case, when it seems to her as though she's combating what you might call a livelier life in the youth of her husband, one that she didn't know and can't have. So she really is up against it in asserting a life of her own, which is not, as I said, I think earlier, this is not a matter of just sort of getting rid of somebody, because grief is burdensome, that you can't get on, so to speak. It's a harder thing than that in many ways, and it's a truer to life thing. That is to say that the loss has got somehow to be incorporated into the life of the living in a way which is, well, you know, to put it mildly, helpful rather than a hindrance to being alive, to staying alive and to wanting to stay alive.
It's a bloody cold truth, though, to think about grief or to understand grief as a measurement of love, whether it's to do with a parent, a brother, a sister or a friend who has passed away.
That's right,
but it did get me thinking, and I thought about my own father as I read through the pages. We all in our grief become somewhat obsessed with details on their past. It's part of the natural process, whether you go back to their childhood or try and find new pictures of your loved one. But it's when that tips over is another matter, isn't it?
Yes, and I think there is in, probably one could say, in most people at a certain age, a will to carry on living. And particularly if you've, you know, if you've loved and it's been reciprocated, then you can, and she's striving to, I think of the person lost as willing her to carry on living a life without him. I mean, he says as much before he dies, and that's when he, I think, you know, it's a kind of touching thing that I've experienced myself, that you want to leave nothing behind that will leave a resentment. You want to leave nothing behind that you feel at that point unforgiven for, and so forth. And that, in a way, is a kind of making it as well as good as possible so that you can go on. I mean, I've known, I'm sure you have as well, deaths which have simply left a colossal burden of not just grief, but guilt or there comes some realization about the person that you loved and who you thought loved you that is devastating. I mean, this kind of thing happens the whole time. And one important thing in the life writer from the outset is that Katrine does not stumble upon a complete secret. It's not as though her husband has concealed anything from her. She knows fully, she knows about Monique. She knows that there's a box full of letters there. And she knows also that he laid no prohibition on her to look at them. And it's her choice to get into all that. And as soon as she gets into it, and she says, this is the only thing I want to do, but as soon as she gets into it, she is at risk. I mean, gravely at risk, really. So.
One of the aspects of Katrine's personality is that she almost seems to have lived through her life through her husband's achievements and successes, that she hasn't possibly seen herself on her own terms in her own experience, that she never saw herself as a kind of a separate sense of herself in some way. Why did you write that, or what questions asking yourself that when in relation?
I mean, with respect, it's not strictly true, because she is an academic, she's a successful one as far as one knows, and she is the writer of these biographies, and they're quite important in it, because her particular choice of the subject for biography is characteristic of her. That is to say that those romantic writers interest her most, in whom there is a real discrepancy between, as it were, aspiration and talent, or the feeling that you are a great writer and actually not being it. And she's interested in that falling short. Now, we don't know any more about that. She talks a little bit about them later on to Daniel, but that's an interesting perspective on her own life, I think, and it comes into play with the feeling that the great romance was lived by her husband prior to her. Now, that's not meant to belittle her, because the more I wrote about her, the greater my admiration for her became, and I think that I tried to depict somebody struggling to stay alive, and I think that is what is happening at the end when she meets up with Monique, and she has the good friend Daniel still there, and it does look, with the symbolic gift of the silver coins, as though something is being passed on, which is of, you know, it has a virtue in it, that is to say, something that's capable of doing her good. And I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously it's hard, it's very, very hard.
I loved the Dr. Gracie character in the book. She offers tremendous advice.
Yes.
She's very wise counsel and very compassionate. She says at one stage in one of her visits to Katrine, she says, she advised her that it's best not to think of grief in terms of progressing along a straight line.
That's right.
And she says, in fact, sequence, progress, degrees, anything linear, and above all, anything serial, these are not helpful concepts for the mending of your life. And then she says something in the lines of, you don't have to convert grief back into what it was, an abiding love. You don't want to throw it off and leave it lying by the wayside. This is not Pilgrim's Progress.
That's right.
You are not making for the Celestial City.
That's right.
thought that was fantastic.
I'm glad you spotted that. That's absolutely critical to the whole thing because, again, in a funny way, writing this, I've gone off the whole notion of serial progression through. I know that one does. I mean, one day and then another day, you are one day older. You proceed in chronological time to your own death. But the actual experience of life is in many ways absolutely not serial. And the more serial it is, I do sincerely now think, the worse you are living. So for some sense of, it's a bit like childhood. When you think back on childhood, particularly childhood holidays, I've done this myself, it's very difficult to say what year it was. There's a sort of phase of childhood which lasts from I don't know when to I don't know when. But particularly if you go back to the same place for a holiday, then you remember a state, effectively. You don't remember a series of occurrences. And I've tried it myself. It's only if there are external events that, as an adult, you recognise as having occurred in, I don't know, what, 1956 or 1961 or whenever, that you can actually locate your childhood in ordinary, what you might call civilised chronological time. So the idea of a state of life in which these things are present. I mean, I might see that this is, as you said at the outset, my chief preoccupation from, well, since the age of 15, 16, really, has been with poetry and what poetry, but also fiction, poetry and fiction together, they conjure up, all of them, a present life. I've had something latterly to do with people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and when they are in the grip of it again, I was talking to a psychotherapist who could explain it, you are not remembering things. It's not as though the mind wanders back and consciously remembers the event that traumatized you. You are physically reliving it. That is to say, it's a bodily state over which you have no control. It's not been processed into memory. It's not been processed through the brain into the area where memories are stored. So you are simply visited by this thing, and anything might trigger it off. And poetry and fiction are a kind of benign, I mean, really, comparatively speaking, very benign version of that. When you read a poem or a novel, you're not actually remembering. It may remind you of things, but you are in a present tense. That is to say, you are living these things. And the more attentively you read, the more passionately, involvedly you are actually reading them. So, and again, that's not linear. That's not linear, and that's not serial. It's present life.
I'm wondering, within all of that, as you're talking about the relationship between poetry and fiction and how we process all the different experiences in our life, as you were writing The Life Writer, presumably you were also processing the grief you've experienced in your own life. Did it help you in some way come to terms with any either questions or thoughts that you had? Because it's a very profound meditation on grief, The Life Writer. So presumably you struggled through it in different ways.
Well, I mean, everybody of a certain age does. And along the way, as in fact Eric says, you know, I've lost, in fact, the character who was Eric was a very dear friend of mine. And before him, I, you know, another man I was deeply fond of was my best friend at university, really. He died at the age of 40-something, and here I am still. I mean, you lose people along the way, and most people lose a close parent or parent or two or three. Or the grief is all loss, and grief is all part of it. And I, you know, I know I made the story up in the way that it is a rather indecent sort of way of going about it. But I mean, I made a story out of the lives of people I know intimately and out of my own life. And, you know, it's all in there, if you like. And it's sorted out into principally three characters, Daniel and Eric and Katrine, with a few others scattered around as well. So,
last question for you, David. Do you think we all are in some ways a bit muddled when it comes to our own memories?
Yes, I do. But there are two things about that. One is you are the agent of it, therefore you can, if you choose to. And a lot of people don't. I mean, but you can, if you choose to, try to sort them out. If you think they're important, you can dwell on them, you can reflect on them, you can perhaps look things up. But also, on the underlying thing in the novel, and the novel certainly, and also in the stories, there is a sort of there's something going on which doesn't want everything sorted out, that wants to entertain possibilities, and, you know, of the possibilities, the ones that are more helpful to life than hurtful to life.
British poet, short story writer and editor David Constantine. The Life Writer is published by Comma Press and retails for just under €12 in paperback. Now I have to say, hand in heart, this is a beautiful read. Poetic, touching and deeply emotional. I absolutely loved it. Okay, coming up next, we're going to delve into the world of deep classics.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Okay, let's stick with the theme of memory and reception and meet with Dr. Shane Butler, Professor of Classics at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, and hear why we should all be reading the ancient classics.
I'm Shane Butler. I teach classics at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, in the States. I've taught various places, most recently in Bristol, in the UK, Los Angeles before that. And I work on Latin literature sort of across the board in antiquity, but also texts written in Latin after the end of the ancient world.
Shane, really well done on the book. It's a superbly curious read. It got me thinking in all sorts of ways and in very unexpected ways. So hats off to you on that one. I might throw you a Greek proverb, if that's okay, to kick things off. And it's a proverb that you do touch on in the introductions to Deep Classics. I'll give you the English version and maybe you can give us the Greek. Beautiful things are difficult. And it got me thinking that possibly the hardest things to understand or conceive or wrestle with are really the most beautiful.
That's such a great one. I'm glad you picked that one of all the ones that are in the book. So that's Kalapata Kala, that's right at the end of Platonic dialogue, the Hippias Major. And Socrates has been talking to this guy Hippias, and they've endeavored to find out what he is. And sort of officially, in the sort of rules of their conversation, at the end of the day, they've reached no answer. And Socrates pretends to throw up his hands and say, you know, the only thing I understand now is that old proverb that beautiful things are difficult. And part of it is his way of saying that beauty is a really difficult thing to talk about and answer questions about. But in a roundabout way, he's also saying the most beautiful thing, especially for a philosopher, is doing exactly that, trying to answer an impossible question. So he turns the proverb into meaning something like difficulty itself is beautiful.
And it really applies to the Greco-Roman world and classical antiquity, because while there's a lot we know, there's a lot we don't know, and it's possible that we're always will be searching. I might ask you about the title of the book, Deep Classics. It raises lots of different connotations, and the cover is pretty spellbinding, to put it mildly. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, it sort of began, as I explained in the book, as a little bit of a joke. I mean, I was talking to a colleague, and we were agreeing that there were some new trends in classics, especially younger scholars seemed to be saying something that didn't quite sound like what the generation before them was saying. And we said, well, what will we call this? What does this all look like? Does it all come together? And I sort of joked that it's really deep. It's a kind of deep classics. And the phrase stuck because it ended up in a way that I don't think I initially intended, describing something about the way that work really unfolds. So if you think about classics as being something that, for example, archaeologists do, you know, they go out into the field, they find a buried city, and they begin digging away. And they dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And you might think that the idea is to dig everything up, recover everything, reconstruct the ancient city. But if you think a little harder, you realize that they'll never get to the bottom of things. Even what's down beneath the earth is fragmented. Even when it's whole, you can't quite understand how it worked, what it was. So classics is this discipline that looks very deep, but it looks deeply at something it'll never really get to the bottom of. And I think that's really interesting.
Now, Deep Classics is a rather eclectic selection of 15 essays on how, I suppose, the Greco-Roman world has been received or understood through art, culture, literature, whatever it is. Within all of that, what was the big question you were asking, and how did the different contributors maybe take to that?
Well, I think, you know, when we began, we thought we were asking a lot of different questions. I mean, there's sort of always been a question, and it resurfaces from time to time with different levels of urgency about why we do classics at all. Why should we care about this civilization 2,000 years ago that we can only partially recover? And I think we just sort of felt that there was a moment of crisis for the humanities, but also a moment of opportunity to ask that question again and see if there was a new answer. And there are bits and pieces of different kinds of answers, but they all sort of converge on this idea that really you sort of began with, which is that it's the struggle to understand antiquity that matters, not so much antiquity itself, but it's the way in which antiquity invites certain kinds of questioning and thinking and flights of imagination. And that's what we really learn. It's about the pose is a word that a lot of the contributors use, how we stare at the past and what that staring, what that positioning in relation to the past really means.
Do you think the past can be fully known? And what I mean by that is, can we plot the past? Can we really engage with it and structure it and fully digest it all? Do you think that's humanly possible?
Well, I mean, it's obviously not. I mean, the thing is that we can't really know anything, if you think about it. We can't know ourselves. We can't know down to the very bottom of their motivations, the people around us, the world in which we live. I mean, life is a mystery. And alas, you know, however smart you are, however hard you work, you'll go to your grave having asked far more questions than you'll ever answer. So classics, the object of classics, antiquity, is like everything else in our world. It's just that it's a very interesting, vibrant, and strangely circumscribed example of this problem of not being able to know something completely, systematize it entirely.
Yeah, you quote Alberto Manguel. He's an Argentine-Canadian academic writer, thinker. He's an incredible man who has a vast library or a vast collection of books. And he has said that no one owns Homer. And I thought that was really interesting. You write that we may well judge books by their covers, but to read them, we must eventually open up to them from the side. I love that, because really we have to come at it from all sorts of creative angles. And sometimes it's not the straightforward, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. No, and it's Homer is such a great example because, you know, when you think about the influence of classical culture, you might say, ah, Homer, this really great poet, everything flows from Homer. But a lot flows from Homer. You can look back at Homer from perspectives that come from any moment in time and practically any point on the globe. And when you follow those all back to this supposed original who was Homer, you know, if you're a good classicist, you know that Homer maybe didn't exist. His poems are the sort of result of centuries of improvisation, the sort of borrowing of various epic traditions. We don't really know. There's no bottom to the question of Homer. So you kind of are always looking at this stack of things, and it's not what they all stand on that matters. It's somehow how they all unfolded. That's the real epic.
Do you think we would have had James Joyce's Ulysses if we didn't have Homer?
God, that's such a great question. I mean, what I would say is this, right, and I think, you know, anyone would agree with me, although maybe not once upon a time, it would be foolish to think that James Joyce is just some kind of distant descendant of this great genius who was Homer. Joyce is, if anything, in opposition to the Homeric tradition. He sort of positions his ethic as something that is different from modernism. It's really a kind of critique of all kinds of literary tradition. But it works precisely because there is that thing to oppose, that thing to wrestle with. And at the end of the day, you know, Joyce is fantastic because he doesn't read like Homer, but he does read in a way like reading an index of Homer or a work of classical scholarship on the difficulty of knowing Homer. There is this kind of struggle in Joyce that's very like the struggle to get to Homer. And so they connect not as one text to another, but as one text to this whole stacked tradition that we open up from the side that you just talked about.
I loved reading your essay, Homer is Deep. It was quite different to some of the other contributors that you had in Deep Classics. And you're looking at a very special relationship, a relationship that has been questioned in lots of different ways, whether it was a friendship or whether it was a love affair. Can you talk to me about it?
Well, it's, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, you have Achilles and Patroclus, and you have parts of Western history absolutely convinced that they were lovers in a sexual sense, other parts of Western history absolutely convinced that they weren't. And then you have in the 19th century these really interesting kinds of architects of what would come to be the struggle for gay rights, who look back and try to see if in Homer and in Greek culture more generally there's something they can use. And it's often thought that they looked back and they said, ah, look, you know, there are these same-sex relationships. Maybe Achilles and Patroclus, you see, you know, we're not so different. But in fact, when you go back to the 19th century, they were doing something much more subtle. You know, they looked and they said, Achilles and Patroclus, who knows what their relationship was? But that's what we want to recapture, is a sense of the unknowability, the complexity, the infinite horizons of love, you know, that you can find anywhere, that maybe a hard line between friendship and eros is not a useful one. We want to find something that's about love in all of its forms. So there's something where someone looked back to antiquity and didn't find the thing they were looking for, but they found a set of questions that made it possible to imagine the thing they were looking for. And that's a very complex but beautiful kind of relationship.
But trying to figure out any relationship, Shane, from the outside, you're always on shaky ground, aren't you?
Yeah, that's the truth. And that's one of the reasons that I think that the difficulty of antiquity, the difficulty of its texts, becomes part of its eloquence. I mean, in the chapter that I wrote, I sort of began with a really easy example, which is that we have this word oinops that Homer uses, which is usually translated as wine dark. It's an adjective that he applies to the sea, and centuries of readers have tried to figure out why does Homer think that the sea looks like wine. One British prime minister actually thought that the Greeks were colorblind, and that's why Homer had used this ridiculous adjective for a sea that's blue, not red. And instead, I think what even Homer, back in the days in which the epic came into being, was doing was using a really old word that he wasn't quite sure what it meant either. And so the more time has unfolded, and the harder it has become to understand what that word actually meant, the more eloquent it's become. It's a kind of mystery already in the poem that becomes even more mysterious as the poem becomes distant from its readers. So that, you know, Homer can use it in this way to already describe something that's very evocative, the sea. And the sea just becomes more and more evocative as time goes on, deeper, if you will.
As a classicist, when people say to you, or whether it's either students or writers or different types of people who engage in culture, say to you that there's a possibility that Homer may not have meant what he said or what he wrote or how we've interpreted it in some way, what do you make of that as a classicist? How does that sit with you? I imagine very uneasy, does it?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, I think that what we want is material. We don't want a blank slate. I mean, a blank slate suits some people. There are lots of creative people. That's what they want. They want a blank canvas. But the classicist is someone who says, no, I want material that's really going to resist me. It's going to demand that I make sense of it. And at the end of the day, what I will write about antiquity will always be a product of me and a product of the world in which I live, the ways that I've been trained. But it won't be something that I would have written if that material had not fought back and wrestled with me. So what I'm producing when I work on antiquity is not a reconstruction of the past, but it's also not just a portrait of me. It's something that meets in the middle, and that I think is what's really important. And that means, though, that the way we read Homer will always change. Every reader of Homer will produce something different.
Can we talk about erotic anger? It was one of the aspects of the book that I particularly enjoyed. It was one of the essays, I'm trying to think, I think it was Medea's Erotic Journey. And the essay talks a lot about jealousy or zealous. And in lots of different ways, when we look at these great tragedies, it's a lot of the time about jealousy, isn't it? It's quite a driver.
Yeah, no, it's a great essay. You know, Julius is a magnificent classicist. But what I love about that essay, I mean, if you want the key to that essay, sort of, I probably shouldn't give it away, but if you want the key to that essay, skip right to the end. And Julia says, the last words of the essay are, I'm jealous. And what the essay then turns out to have been is this real search for a kind of emotion, a very modern emotion, a deeply felt emotion that any of us might have felt, probably have felt, right? And she finds it in antiquity, but she doesn't find it under any particular word. There's not an exact translation of erotic jealousy. Jealousy in our usual sense in antiquity. But that doesn't mean it didn't exist. So she surveys this whole great field, and she finds people who clearly are feeling the way that she feels. And she says, look, there it is. You know, it's not in the dictionary. It's not that simple. But I can find myself in antiquity. Now, does that mean she invented a reflection of herself? No. Does that mean that antiquity was exactly like modernity? Not that either. But somehow, something has happened in that engagement. It's an incredible moment of human connection.
There's a lovely essay by Lara Jansen. She brings up the Argentinian short story writer, Borges. And she quotes Borges saying something on the lines of, in all our reading, that the text is somewhat unfinished, that it never ends. We're always connecting some aspect of the page to something else. We're always following on. And it's that this kind of synergy and relationship between the reader, what's been said, what's been not said, that there's lots of different missing pieces. It's a lovely thought, really, isn't it? Because it makes everyone into this community of readers, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, Jansen's piece ends the volume, and it's a beautiful way to sort of fade off into the work of now what we must do, having thought through these questions. But, you know, we begin the volume with Mungel, the last reader to Borges when he was blind. And so there's a kind of ring composition, and it's not an accident that, you know, Borges and Mungel take us outside Europe, the Western world, you know, readers from Latin America who are a reminder that that community extends in time and space, and everybody adds a little piece to this machine, you could almost say, that is the unfolding work of understanding antiquity. And what it produces, you know, it's not like Borges's Aleph, you know, this famous machine in the middle of one of his stories that embodies all knowledge to which we might someday, you know, imagine having access. It's not like Google either, right? It's a much more complicated machine. And I think Borges gets it just right, and Janssen picks up on this. You know, what we're looking for is a way to understand what it means to know some things in a vast universe where we know very little. What's that in-betweenness between knowing and not knowing? That's where we really live. That's what we need reflections of so that we can understand how better to live a life that's predicated on that uncertainty.
So for anyone who thinks there's a right or wrong way to read the classics, what do you say to them, Shane?
The important thing is to read them. That's the most important thing. The wrong way to read the classics is not to read them at all. I mean, it's not because they have some sort of intrinsic value. You know, we've given up on this idea that antiquity was the greatest culture that ever existed. We know that it had all kinds of problems and that lots of other cultures have been great and that we live in a world that's a kind of hybrid anyway. But nevertheless, for almost 2,000 years, we've been wrestling with the question of antiquity after antiquity. We've been building this multi-layered machine again that produces certain kinds of engagement, certain kinds of questions. And I think they're incredibly important. In fact, I think they're incredibly timely right now. I mean, one of the things that the book aims to do is to point out the ways in which classics, especially 2 or 3 centuries ago, was very hard to distinguish from some of the natural sciences. You know, geology was very similar. It looked deep into the earth and deep into the past, and it tried to answer questions, but also was awestruck by all that it couldn't know. And I think that sense of awe, that sense of not knowing, is something we need to recapture in the 21st century. The science is not about easy answers. Science is about asking hard questions, questions you may not ever be able to answer. I think classicists and scientists and everyone else have a real stake in recovering that sense of the beauty of difficulty of Socrates.
So Shane, if you were to recommend maybe 5 classic texts that somebody could go out this evening and buy, which possibly have relevance or resonance to where we are today or how they make sense of the world, what would they be?
Oh, dear heavens, that's so difficult. I mean, because part of the problem here is that the real work is the work of stumbling around and choosing yourself. I mean, that's the beautiful image that Borges has, you know, of wandering through this infinite library. I mean, that's our sort of modern condition, is that we have too much to choose from. And I know it's very tempting to say, oh, I need an expert to tell me what to read. But I think the better lesson is that, you know, anything that's been produced by a human being and read by other human beings, this layering of reading, this investment of time and energy, you know, there's something in there. And they all fundamentally, however they may seem to be different, they all offer an insight into what it means to be part of this community of humans stretched across time. You can pick the great classics, the things that have been read and overread. You can read Homer, you can read Virgil. I'm a big fan of Cicero. But off the beaten track, there are people like Aulus Gellius. He's a big favorite of mine. And he was someone, he lived in ancient Rome, but he already understood Roman culture as something that existed in fragments. He was he would haunt bookstalls and buy books of texts that he'd never heard of before. He's a minor author, but in some ways, he's a better way into the thought world of antiquity and how we've continued to think about antiquity than the big classics are. But I'd say just go where your heart takes you. Thank you.
Scholar, editor and teacher Dr. Shane Butler. Deep Classics, Rethinking Classical Reception. It's published by Bloomsbury and retails for in around €22 in paperback. I have to say this is a stunning collection of essays, superbly written, captivating and well argued. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Now, before I head off tonight, I've a handy little competition for you from the good people at Books Ireland. All you have to do is answer this fairly straightforward question and email talkingbooks@newstalk.com, and the first email past the post, so to speak, wins an annual subscription to Books Ireland. Okay, here goes. 2017 marks the 350th anniversary of the birth of which satirical Irish author? Yeah, I think it's an easy one. So again, all you have to do is email talkingbooks@newstalk.com. Best of luck. Okay, well, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the profound and thoughtful words of Argentine short story writer, poet and essayist Jorge Luis Borges, who wrote, "Nothing is built on stone, all is built on sand, but we must build as if the sand were stone." Fine words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.